Welcome to Type Tune Tint. I'm Tom Kranz.
Potato knishes. Potato knishes. I love potato knishes.
Knishes are a traditional Jewish snack food first introduced to the United States at the turn of the century and now a staple in many Jewish households. Homemade knishes are the jumping-off point for the new children's book, Wishes and Knishes, by today's guest, Yona Diamond Dansky, a career educator who started writing children's books later in life. As I find out during our chat, Wishes and Knishes is about much more than food.
I love potato knishes.
And we're joined by Yona Diamond Dansky from her palatial estate in suburban Philadelphia, a little suburb called Elkins Park, where I actually spent, as I just told her, a year of my life after graduating Temple and moving out of my parents' house. I lived for a year in Elkins Park and that whole part of Montgomery County I'm very familiar with. Yona, how are you?
I'm good. And welcome to the ninth floor of Elkins Park.
Of your
Park
palatial
house.
Estate. Yeah, exactly. So Yona joins us on the occasion of publishing her second children's book. Have mine right here. It's called Wishes and Knishes. And we're going to explain all that to you in just a second. But first of all, let's get a little bit of a background on who you are. So the thumbnail sketch I got from your website is that you are a career educator, basically. What does that mean?
That means I was a teacher and an administrator, a whole bunch of different, I had different jobs. I worked at the Free Library of Philadelphia, Community College of Philadelphia. I worked in Bucks County, at the Bucks County Intermediate Unit. I've been in a million schools. I worked for a lot of places. And I'm an educator. So no matter what my position was, I feel like I'm always an educator, lifelong educator.
But you started out teaching deaf kids, basically, right?
I did, which is an interesting thing. I went to Temple also, and I wanted to be a teacher of the deaf at that time, is what we were called. And Temple didn't have that. So Temple had a million things, and I could only go to Temple. My parents didn't have enough money to send me away to another, you know, a sleepaway in a dorm college. So, we lived in Levittown at the time. So I actually spent some time at aunts who lived in the Philadelphia area and commuted to Temple. And because Temple didn't have what I wanted, I ended up in a roundabout way getting a job at the Pennsylvania School for the Deaf in 1970. Hmm. They didn't have enough people who had certifications, so they hired us and then provided classes on site, and as well as we would drive out to Trenton and take classes there. And I got my certification in a roundabout way that way.
I see. So did you have somebody in your family who was hearing impaired? Is that what your interest started as?
So my mother was hard of hearing, and we just yelled, you know, we just growing up, we just talked loud. You know, I still do. So, and then when a cousin married a hearing aid dealer, my mother got a hearing aid and we still talked loud. So that was my, you know, interaction with somebody with a hearing impairment. And when I was 16, I got a job also by accident, in a camp called Variety Club Camp. And it was for handicapped children run by the Variety Club in California, you know, the entertainment industry. And I came in the middle of the summer. They called me and I would replace somebody who had been there and was sick. So I come in the middle of the summer. I'm like dropped into this place, which was remarkable. It's just an incredible place. The site exists now, but everything changed in that field so that there were no more, like, you couldn't just isolate all the people with disabilities altogether. But that's where I first saw a deaf child. There was a deaf child in my class. I remember her name. I remember her clearly, my class, in my cabin. She would sit on the green bench and scrape the paint and eat it. You know, it was like leaded paint, I'm sure. Yeah. And all the other kids, you know, were hobbling around in wheelchairs and what do you call them? Crutches and whatever. And, you know, the deaf kids, they would have a few of them because kids would just run off and you couldn't just say like, hey, come back. You know, they wouldn't hear you. So that was my first contact. And I remember having going around the cabin and saying, when is your birthday? Because if it was during the summer, we would have a party. And I wrote to her, you know, when is your birthday? And she looks at it and she, you know, like, I don't know. What does this mean? So the girl was about 12 years old and clearly bright. And I couldn't understand why she didn't respond to when is your birthday? You know, simple question written down. And I later found out why. First of all, Spanish was her family's language. So that's her background. And learning English as a deaf person is very difficult if you've never heard it. You know, if you try to imagine yourself, if you're going to learn Russian or French or something without ever hearing it, and you have a language to base it on. So it really sparked my interest. And I said, well, I want to find out more about this and why. So
that was, there you have it. Well, that's interesting. And so obviously, you know, American Sign Language, like, and you're fluent. And then you went on and you became basically a career educator doing many different things. And now you're basically retired from full-time work, but you do other things just like me. I'm retired from full-time work, but I still do other things because if you don't do other things, you know, what happens? You shrivel up and die, basically. All right. So let's get to the book that we're talking about today, Wishes and Conditions. You not only wrote this book, but you did all the artwork. So that impresses the hell out of me. Were you always an artist? Did you always draw? Or is this, did you wake up one day in your 50s and say, I'm gonna draw?
I always drew. And I was not a writer. I live with writers. Everybody in my family got great writers. And I was never considered myself a great writer. But I do have stories to tell. So I worked at it. I really worked at the writing part, but the art part. So I was always an artist of sorts growing up, but I never had the confidence to do this as a full-time profession. I grew up, you know, rather on the poor side. My father was a cabinet maker. He made furniture. He made beautiful furniture, but he didn't make a lot of money. So I said, well, I'm not doing that. I'm not going that route. I want to, you know, have a life with a little more. I don't need to be rich, but I need to not be poor. So I figured I can always do art on the side, which is not always true. It's really hard to fit it in, you know, wherever, you know, especially after kids.
Oh, it's like that with anything, Chris. Writing is the same way. You know, you have to sit down and make time. You just have to.
Right. Right.
So anyway.
I did a lot of artwork on the side until I was too tired and I couldn't do it anymore. I did all kinds of different things. I had a wheel. One of the interesting connections I had in my job that led me to doing art, several things. One, I worked at Community College of Philadelphia, and they were starting a program for deaf students, having deaf people come in and having interpreters in the classroom. This was way back in the early 70s. So sign language was just taking hold. There really wasn't a professional community registry of interpreters for the deaf. There wasn't any. It was just beginning. And I said, I raised my hand. Oh, I can do that. You know, it was very unprofessional, but there wasn't a profession at that time. So they hired me. They had two deaf women watch me interpret in the classroom. And they said, oh, she's fine. Okay, whatever. And that's how I got hired. So I worked there, and I was the first deaf student they had was took art classes. And I sat there, you know, twiddling my thumbs. There's nothing to say. They're all doing their artwork. So I picked up a paintbrush and I started to paint. And I took ceramics class and I started to do ceramics. And of course, the second they needed me, I would come over and interpret. But very, very unprofessional. I don't recommend it to anyone to do it that way. But I was able to get a handle on some things that I really didn't know. And
well, you kept doing it and you got better at it.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you keep doing it. And the illustrations in this book are really great. I mean, you can see that they speak to children. The thumbnail sketch of Wishes and Conditions is we have, first we need to do glossary items. We need to define a knish and we need to define Bubby. Bubby is the main character here. Bubby is essentially a Jewish grandmother, correct? A term of endearment, like Nana, Oma, whatever. Yeah. And tell us, what is a, I mean, a lot of us know what a knish is, but tell us what it is.
Okay. So a knish is like a piece of pastry with very thin layers. And inside it's a stuffing of all kinds, potato knishes. You can have meat knishes, kasha knishes. You can have liver knishes, which I never really had. And you could rice knishes, which were my favorite because they were sweet. But you could put almost anything inside. But potato knishes is like, this is the thing, you know.
That's kind of the baseline. Right. So in this book, Bubby is the knish master, I suppose. And the book basically focuses on her granddaughter, Kaylee, who wants Bubby to teach her how to make knishes. And every time Bubby says, sure, whenever you wish, something comes up in Kaylee's life. And this keeps going on for years. Kaylee's busy. She's got school. She's got, I don't know, some kind of extracurricular activity. Suddenly, she's much older. And the last time she asks Bubby, you know, to help her teach her how to make the knishes, Bubby says, well, now I can't see very well because now Bubby has gotten older. But the bottom line is she basically tells her what the recipe is. Kaylee gets it. She figures it out. And the moral of the story is, I guess, extending tradition is making traditions and carrying them through your family. Why did you write this book? What is there? Was there a family connection here? Or tell me why you wrote this.
Well, I'm a Bubby, but this Bubby is really based on my mother.
Okay.
And I learned to make knishes. And Kaylee, my niece, also learned. We are the only ones in the family that for years and years could make these knishes.
Okay.
So when Kaylee was getting married, I get this invitation. I'm thinking, uh-oh, who's going to make the knishes for Kaylee's wedding? You know, this is like the first big event that my mother is no longer with us. She made knishes for every event, and she brought them. It didn't matter how fancy, the wedding was, or her knishes were there. And so it was like, uh-oh, now what? And that also, I think, around that same time, I had taken a visit to New York and went to the Tenement Museum. And I saw, have you been there?
No.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a place where my ancestors came, my grandparents came and were tailors. And so not that they were in New York, but the same kind of situation, you know, all these people came and they were tailors and the sweatshops were really in their houses. You visited these places and it just made me connect with my grandparents.
Okay.
And so between that and the invitation to the wedding, that kind of sparked this story, you know, and then it had many incarnations because I was trying to worm in there how my mother learned to cook, which is not in this story. And I put in just pieces of things. And this isn't, Kaylee was always busy with things, but she was not too busy to learn. The real Kaylee learned how to, she was really enthusiastic and she wanted to learn. She did learn. She was, and she and I were the only ones. So that's why we're both in, you know, kind of, you know, in here.
Got it. So the book, as I've interviewed a couple other children's book authors, and I found in your book the same thing I found in theirs, which is that there's stuff in here for adults as well, right? You know, and for there's all kinds of less. Well, I mean, the first thing is that I care about because I like to cook. The recipe for Bubby's knishes is like on page 3, which is awesome. And wow, they're much easier to make than I thought. I mean, the knish itself, it's basically water, flour, and eggs, right? It's all about the technique, I guess. But there are other lessons in here for kids and adults. And did you write it with that purpose?
Well, because I'm an educator, I'm always like pull out things that, oh, well, let's look at that. I mean, you could, as a teacher, if I were a teacher picking up this book, I would look at blindness, for example, and talk about, you know, in addition to food and culture and what kind of culture, kind of food is good in your culture and, you know, what kinds of things does your family make? And what do you consider special? And who's made something special for you? And let's write the recipe out. And, you know, all kinds of things that you could do as a teacher. But the blindness, and if there is one thing that you didn't mention, it was on the page where they're cooking, where they're baking. And Kaylee puts her hands on top of her bubbies, because the biggest issue with this is stretching and pulling the dough. That is the technique that you you really need. You almost need to Google it, you know, look for a YouTube video. Yeah. And we do have someone put together, my brother-in-law put together a website when my parents were alive. So they have them making the knishes. And so it's on a little family website, which I could send you. Just, you know, anybody can look at it. It's cute. And it has my father being the assistant stirring the onions and, you know, but the pulling and the stretching of the dough is the hardest, is the key.
I got you. You write on your website, when you talk about this book, other related topics to explore with children while you're reading: priorities, decision-making, blindness, you mentioned because Bubby loses her sight, life celebrations in different cultures, aging, relationships with grandparents, et cetera. You know, that presumes that you actually sit down and read with the child. And I'm not sure how many people actually do that today with little lit screens every place, but that's an important lesson. I mean, I did that with my boys, and hopefully a lot of parents are still doing it today.
Right. Well, also if teachers use this in a classroom, like if I market this, and marketing is not, I need to do some marketing, but if I market this to, say, Jewish schools and libraries there, and so a teacher might use this in a classroom lesson, and then, you know, you could use it for math, you could use it for the recipe, and how do you measure all these things, and what do the measurements mean? I mean, you could go in a million different directions as a teacher. You can pick up on any one of these things.
Yeah. Sure, absolutely. All right, we are going to take a little break for me to do some shameless self-promotion, and we'll be back in about a minute or so. More with Yona Diamond Dansky in just a moment.
The Earth is dying a slow death. The 5,000 people living on the moon are in trouble. Their paradise has become a cautionary tale of human weakness. We need a hero. Enter Rick Mack and the Planetary Commission to save the Earth, the Moon, and themselves. Moon Rescue: Escape from the Dome by Tom Krantz. Now available in ebook, paperback, hardback, and audiobook.
And we're back with Yona Diamond Dansky, author of a new children's book, as we've been talking about wishes and knishes. But you wrote another book as well. And that, I don't know how long ago that was, but tell us about that book. So that one is called Mushu Worries. And this is a children's book that takes place kind of through the eyes of a pet dog, correct?
That was my intention.
Okay.
So this was published in 2019.
Okay.
And it was sitting in my head for about 10 years.
Really?
Well, at that time, well, not quite 10 years. But what happened was, and this was my first, and so it was a real learning experience. I learned a lot about children's books and publishing and the whole fan art, whatever. And it could be a little more polished, but in my opinion. But what happened was, my daughter, 13 years ago, was diagnosed with cancer. She had lymphoma, and she had a three-year-old at the time. So she went through chemo and radiation, and we were helped. We were left like helping her and her husband, who was, you know, going to work every day, and our heads were spinning, and we didn't know what we were doing. And thankfully, she's fine today. She has another child, and everything is good.
Good.
However, at the time, we were looking for books to read to the three-year-old to help him, because he was, you know, very upset by what was going on. He was very clingy. He didn't you know, how do you explain this to a three-year-old? So I had in my head, I said, well, it's not going to happen now, but someday I'm going to write the story that's going to help another child get through this, because there are no books for this particular child in this particular situation. There are books that explain what cancer is. Well, he doesn't need to know what cancer is. He's three, you know, almost four. And he was a book person. And we were book people. So we were looking for books. So
you're looking for a book that talked about the whole deal of living with a family member without getting too detailed, more or less from a kid's point of view that a child could understand.
Right. And this way, from the dog's point of view, because it was easier. It wasn't as painful from your own point of view. That was my feeling, was that it was from a dog's point of view. And it's more of like we didn't know. There's no promise that she's going to get better. There's no promise of anything the next day. There's only being in the moment. And how can you make the most of the moment? So that was kind of like my thought in doing this. And it was useful. The feedback I've gotten from people that I know who have used it, mostly social workers, people who have children who are in grief sessions and, you know, those kinds of situations. And even a friend who has a sister, an adult sister who had mental disabilities and whatever, they've used this. And it was so, they, you know, raved about how useful it was. It didn't get a wide acceptance because I think it was published by a hybrid company. So it's not a traditional publisher. Sure. So right away, it doesn't get into libraries. Yeah. It doesn't.
You have to do that. Like do it yourself marketing mostly.
Do it yourself marketing. And but I learned a lot from doing this. And I also did a lot of the illustrations are all done on my iPad. So
you did those illustrations as well, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So you did those illustrations on an iPad. What did you do the illustrations for Wishes and Knishes on?
iPad.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. There's something called Procreate.
Oh, sure.
You know, and I've used that and I love working, you know, with a paintbrush and a paper and the whole business, but I'm where I live now, it doesn't lend itself easily to spreading out and making a mess.
Yeah, sure.
So I can take that with me wherever I go and I can, it's just useful for me now as a, you know, as an older person and without space to work.
Gotcha. So if you don't mind me asking, how old were you when you wrote the first book?
Oh, now I have to do math.
50s? So just generally. No, 50s, so 40s?
That was 2019. Well, it took years in the making. So say 10, it was 10 years ago. So I'm going to be 75. So I was 65.
Yeah. So you... I didn't start really writing until I retired in my early 60s. I think it's so cool that we do this. I mean, did it ever occur to you earlier to sit down? I mean, when you were a teacher and you had all these great experiences with the deaf kids and then teaching different venues, did it ever occur to you to write about it or not really?
No. I mean, the only writing I did at that time as a teacher, I did curriculum writing and, you know, those kinds of things. But I never, ever considered myself a writer. Yeah. And I still, even today, because I have a son who's a writer, he's in the Writers Guild on strike right now, but, you know, he's a writer. My husband is an excellent writer. My brothers, my sister-in-law, all these people in my family are really good writers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do other things. I just never thought of myself as a writer, but I have stories to tell. And I have four more that are already written and polished manuscripts that I'm sending out and trying to find a publisher for. And I'd be happy if someone else did the artwork, but if they won't, I'll do it myself. And I'm going to get these out there.
I had this conversation with a woman I worked with at Channel 10 in Philadelphia, who went on to become a news anchor, and she retired in her 60s and she picked up a sketch pad at age 60 something. And now she does acrylic art. She's selling her paintings. She's showing them. And she said, she never gave herself permission to draw. And that's what it comes down to so often for us, you know, between, you know, the family and our careers and just plain old raw denial. We say, you know, you even said, I never considered myself a writer. Well, consider yourself a writer, damn it, you know, and just sit down and write, you know, and sit down and draw. So I'm this always interests me. If you do both the illustrations and the writing, what do you do first when you come up with the book?
The written story.
You sit down and write the words and then you do illustrations to match.
So I have a list of ideas. that I keep. And I mean, several weeks ago, I woke up in the middle of the night and I had an idea. This was like the first sentence of a book. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I'll remember that in the morning. I said, no, I won't. I'm writing it down. And I wrote it down. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere it's written down. And that will be added to, I have like seven or eight ideas for future books. I have four that are written already, but I have additional ideas. I could go on
children's books also?
All children's books. Okay. All children's picture books. What happened was I got this idea and then I had to learn the field. So I joined Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. I went to conferences. I mean, I learned everything I could because, I mean, everybody thinks, oh, I can write a children's book. It's really easy. It's really not easy. Mm. You know, you're limited to 32 pages. You have to think about the page turns and make, you know, you've got to have the character development and a plot and a blah, blah, blah. It's not as easy as it looks, even though everyone, we've all read children's picture books.
Sure.
We think, oh, that's easy to do. And it's really not, you know, it has to be a limited number of words, you know, about 500 words, you know, it's a lot to do. And also to appeal to children. Like you said, this could appeal to adults more than children even. But
Well, I like the fact that if you can find stuff for adults in these books, that makes it interesting for the adults when they have to read it. I interviewed a married couple who are Muslim, and she's an art teacher here where I live. And, you know, she's very big on when Ramadan comes around every year, you know, and you've got a couple of girls here wearing hijabs, right? And so she wrote a book. I don't have it. Oh, the Ramadan tree. You know, people celebrate Ramadan. Some of them celebrate them with trees and they decorate. And, you know, the non-Muslim kids have all these questions. And so she wrote a book about that for children. And I found it really interesting. I mean, I read all this, learned a lot of stuff too. So you've got, now that you have opened the floodgates, now that you've given yourself permission to write, so now you've got all these ideas. So now all you have to do is write them, right? Simple. That's easy for me to say, right? You have to write them and you have to draw them. But
I have to redraft them and get critiques and then, you know, decide if I want to take somebody's information, you know, their critique and their whatever. You know, it's a lot. And it's a lot of revision, a lot of
sure. Yeah, well, I've written like six novels and I've self-published all of them. And I just reread all of them. I try to read them as an average schlepper out there who doesn't know nothing about nothing. And every single time, excuse me, every single time I find two handfuls of things that I would change, that I would correct. Oh, this sucks. Why did I write that? You know, and even while I'm in the process, I do the same thing. I walk away for a week and I sit down and I can't believe that came out of my, you know, out of my brain. So it's an ongoing process, but that's all good. That's what creativity is all about. It's dynamic and whatnot. So where do we buy your books? Are you on Amazon or do we go to your website or where do we get them?
Either way, it'll lead you to Amazon. I have a link on my website, yonadiamonddansky.com, or just go to Amazon and Google the names of the books, Mushu Worries or Wishes and Knishes. That's the best way. You know, you can just Google the name and it should come up.
Great. Well, I'll be looking forward to your next book. How far are you from publishing your next work, do you think?
Well,
I was this year, next year?
I was close. I don't have a publisher yet. I was really close. I had some good nibbles and then, they got away.
Yeah.
But I have high hopes. I have some they're all very different actually. What's interesting is, you know, I feel like 75, like the window is closing. I have this sense of urgency. I've got to get all this on paper. You know, I got to do this because I don't know when it's going to end. You know, I mean, my parents lived until they were 97, but you know, we have no guarantee about tomorrow.
Yeah, so, of course.
And the older you get, the more you feel that. And so I have the sense of urgency to get these things, you know, to just get them out. You know.
Well, I wish you all the best, and I'll be looking forward to it. I really appreciate you joining me today from Elkins Park, Yona Diamond Dansky with Wishes and Knishes. And ladies and gentlemen, give it a shot and go buy the book. And Yona, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Potato Knishes. I love potato Knishes.
the Earth is dying a slow death. The 5,000 people living on the moon are in trouble. Their paradise has become a cautionary tale of human weakness. We need a hero. Enter Rick Mack and the Planetary Commission to save the Earth, the moon, and themselves. Moon Rescue, Escape from the Dome by Tom Krantz. Now available in ebook, paperback, hardback, and audiobook. These are the questions explored in the podcast, Type Toon Tint. Tom Krantz chats with writers, musicians, and artists, most of whom found their talent by accident, late in life, or hiding under layers of denial. Subscribe to Type Toon Tint wherever you get your podcasts.